Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 25th of September. We have so much to talk about with Sally Quinn this hour. Sally Quinn is a Washington Post journalist, and she is an author. She describes herself as an Army brat, brought up on Army posts all over the world. And she's become very interested in religion lately. She has started working with John Meacham, who is the editor of Newsweek, and she co-moderates with him On Faith, which is a blog from The Washington Post and Newsweek, and it's hosted by a panel of religious scholars of all denominations. She talks about becoming interested in religion, and she's written some blogs about some areas we're going to get into, and I think it's going to be a rip-roaring good discussion. She talks about Sarah Palin and her children and the role of motherhood and her own child and cutting back from work a little bit because she thinks that mothers still bear primary responsibility for their children. She talks about Elizabeth Edwards and John Edwards and the enabling wives. I'm sure she's going to have a lot to say about this campaign, which I'm sure she's watching very closely. And what kind of debate? Should we start with that? What kind of debate are we going to have tomorrow night with one candidate? Or is there a chance that John McCain will show up for tomorrow night's debate? Is it a way to give Sarah Palin, this is just what crossed my mind, maybe you disagree totally, a little more time to prepare for the vice presidential debate, because McCain's plan was to take next week's vice presidential debate, move that debate on a little bit so the presidential candidates could debate next week instead of tomorrow night. So we got a lot to talk about, including the president's comments last night about the economy. And we welcome phone calls for Sally. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. How else you can join us is by going to our email, which is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, for you to join our conversation. Sally Quinn, hi. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm delighted to have you here. We have so much to talk about. What's the story with tomorrow night's debate? How can you debate if one person is there? Is that what is likely to happen?
Well, if I had to guess, I would say that John McCain will probably end up doing the debate. I feel like it would be such a cop-out for him, and it would be so grandstanding. I mean, as Obama said the other day, you know, when you're president, you have to be able to talk and chew gum at the same time, you know, that is his presence so important that he has to, he can't take an hour off for a debate or 2 hours off for a debate, when I think this is probably one of the most important elections we've ever had in this country. And people are still, so many people are still so undecided. I think the debates are probably more important than they ever have been. And I think it's an absolute obligation for these people, for us as citizens, mm-hmm. and for them, to let us see who they are and what their positions are, so that we can be informed when we go to the polls. And I just think it would be a huge mistake for McCain to drop out of this. And I think it would be a ploy. I don't think it's a, you know, there's no way he can say I can't fit in a couple hours for the debate. His presence is not that important for those hours tomorrow evening on Capitol Hill. I think it would not look good for him. Ultimately, it would look like he was grandstanding and he was bailing out. So I think he probably will do it. I don't know what they would do. If I were they and McCain dropped out, I would simply have an hour long conversation with Obama,
which is probably what will happen, right?
Yeah,
right.
And just, I mean, but you know, Obama being would literally have the whole platform to himself to be able to talk about his views on issues.
It seems,
I think, couldn't be good for McCain.
Right. It seems to me, Sally, as though there's been so much, a phenomenal amount of interest in the conventions on both sides. People are anticipating their Friday night to be sitting around the television and watching these debates. There's huge interest in this.
Yeah.
And for it not to happen,
yeah,
what are you going to do? Go to a fish fry? Whatever you do, you know, isn't going to be as good, right?
well, We're having about 10 people and macaroni and cheese to watch the debate. So.
Macaroni and cheese.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's a mainstream America thing.
That's right.
That's what we eat here.
You want to be comforted. You have said, and others have said, that this is one of the most important elections that we've had. Why do you say that, Sally?
Well, if you look at where we are in the world, where this country is in the world today on every level, whether it's from an economic standpoint or a political standpoint, when you look at the environment, I mean, the issues today are all really crucial issues. And which way we go, depending on which way we go, is really going to determine, I think, the fate of this country. And I don't mean to sound, overwrought about this, but I do think, I mean, our reputation around the world is mud. People don't like Americans, and people don't trust us, and people feel that we are arrogant, and that it's our way or the highway, and we're bullies, and we don't want to talk to people. And now with the crisis, the economic crisis, people don't trust us financially anymore, that they see us as weak and divided. And so I think that whoever takes this job is going to have huge, huge issues to deal with. They're going to have to get our financial situation back to where it's working. They're going to have to improve our relationships in the world. They're going to have to deal with Middle Eastern problems. I mean, North Korea is, a news story today. Nuclear weapons, terrorism, health issues, the environment, all of those things are sort of at a crisis point right now. And I can't remember any time where there have been this many crises in so many different situations on so many different levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the person who takes over this country is going to have an enormous number of problems. And who that person is, how that person handles it, and really importantly, who that person surrounds himself with, the people. I think one of the big, for me anyway, having lived in Washington more years than I can remember, that the people who surround the president, the people the president chooses to surround himself with, end up being the most important decisions the president makes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the people who failed have failed because they didn't surround themselves with the best people.
Which brings us to, I wasn't going to go this direction, but I will, Sarah Palin. And you've written about her. You've said some things that have generated very deep conversations. Mm. I think you're real honest in what you write about her. But I have to believe that there must have been somebody who is just a little more prepared. I must say that I'm somewhat troubled that she's...
You don't mind my laughing, do you?
She just needs these cram courses in all these very important issues. And I would think that that would be troublesome to a lot of the American people. You also have written about the fact, and I think there's some truth in this, but it's going to create a lot of phone calls of people who will disagree, that she does have 5 children. She has a child with Down syndrome. You've had a special needs child, that mothers are still really at the forefront of caring for their children, that she has a daughter who's going to be giving birth, and this is a heck of a lot on the plate, isn't it, when you're cramming to find out who the leaders of the world are.
Well, yeah, that's two different issues. Actually, they meld into one issue. But on the issue of her being qualified and prepared, when I first heard about this, I was appalled, and I wrote a piece saying this is an insult to women because, there are many women who are prepared and qualified, but to choose someone who is so clearly not qualified is insulting, and it's really outrageous. Then I heard her speak at the convention, and I thought that she did a brilliant job. I mean, I thought that she gave a very good speech. I know someone else wrote it, but then everyone has speech writers, and I thought she delivered it well, and she had, she had an enormous amount of poise and confidence, and I thought, well, this person could be formidable, but it has not played out that way. And, I mean, I have a lot of Republican friends. I don't know one single Republican, and I'm talking about the highest powered Republicans in the country. I don't know one of them who isn't absolutely appalled by this choice, because, and what they say is, to me, and I'm talking about, in fact, I don't know one Republican who thinks that this is a good choice or thinks that she's prepared to be president of the United States. I mean, not just vice president, but she's likely to be president of the United States.
Right.
I mean, John McCain is 72 years old and has had melanoma four times, which is a deadly cancer. So it is not unlikely that she'll be president of the United States. And I think that the Republicans are just out of their minds that this person might end up being president of the United States, because she is simply not qualified by any stretch of the imagination. And this is not saying anything against her personally. This is just saying what her background is. I think that's, you know, John McCain has always said, I'll put my country first, but he didn't put his country first. You cannot say, he cannot look someone in the eye with a straight face and say, I chose the person who I believe is most qualified to take over as president if anything happens to me. He simply can't say that because it is not true. And Obama made the choice of Joe Biden because he felt Joe Biden was the person who could be the most qualified to take over as president if anything happened to him. And that, so that's not putting your country first. That's putting yourself and your campaign first. By putting someone who is clearly unqualified to be vice president, certainly president, in that job. So that's how I feel about that.
Mm-hmm.
On the other issue of her children, I think that we are, I feel that we're in a sort of post-feminist world right now. And I was part of the feminist movement, and I believe very strongly in the feminist movement, and I wrote about it a lot, but I also saw that I felt that a lot of the feminists were going way too far the other way, you know. And what by saying we want equality is one thing. I don't see how anybody can be against equality for women in any area. I don't understand that. I basically think that women should rule the world. That's my view of women. I think women are extraordinary and capable and strong and brilliant. And I went to Smith College, which is an all-girls college, and all the smartest people I knew were women. So, you know, I came out of Smith thinking women are just as smart, if not smarter than men. But I've always been concerned about the feminist movement more or less denigrating womanhood and motherhood and the value, the differences, not celebrating the differences, basically saying we're all the same. And I don't think that being treated equally is the same as saying that we're not different. You know, you can be different and still be treated equally. Equal pay for equal work, all of this stuff is a no-brainer. The idea that mothers shouldn't work, we got over that years ago.
Sure.
Of course mothers should work. They should if they want, and they shouldn't if they don't want to. And they can. I mean, that's what we all fought for, was the choice to do what you want, which is why so many young women today are taking time off when they have children.
Mm-hmm.
Because they feel like they can do that now that, you know, we've fought the good fight and come to the other side, which is that, you know, most mothers in this country do work. You know, the majority of women who are parents are working because sometimes they have to, sometimes they want to. So that's not the issue here. But the issue for me is I've been a working mother for 26 years. I have a 26-year-old son. And I know that mothers and fathers are different, and mothers' roles and fathers' roles are different. And no one can deny that. Any mother who has ever had a child, any woman who's ever had a child, will tell you that the burden of parenthood falls on the mother. That's just the way it is.
Right.
I mean, the mothers are the ones who run the show.
Mm-hmm.
And the fathers do what they do, but, you know, they don't have the guilt and the conflict and all of that that women do. They just don't. I mean, I don't know a single woman, and all of my friends are extremely high-powered, You know, my friends are CEOs and they're bankers and they're government officials and senators and directors and, you know, and they all have children, almost all of them, editors and whatever. And I know what their lives are like, and I know what my life is like, and I know what they talk about and their concerns. And it's just not what the men talk about, you know, right. It just isn't. They don't have the same conflicts and the same feeling of tension that women do who are trying to balance it all off. So when I look at Sarah Palin and I say, first of all, we know that having five children is not a feat. I mean, that anybody can have five children. I mean, this is not an accomplishment. You know, whether you have one child or no children or five children, it's not difficult to get pregnant and have a baby. Mm-hmm. The difficult part is being a mother and being a parent. And I think that when you make the choice that you're going to be a parent, then you have an obligation to the child. And I think that mothers have more of an obligation to their children than fathers do. And that is simply, and that's not sexist. That's simply saying that this is the way we are made. I mean, mothers give birth, fathers don't. Does that mean that women are unequal? I think that makes women superior. You know, we have the gift of giving birth and of creating life that men don't have. I mean, it's a huge advantage, I would think. But I think that when you have five children, then there are several issues here. First of all, you have to you make a commitment that this is what you're going to do, and then you do your best to try to raise these children to be good citizens and to have happy and productive lives. And everyone makes different choices. And I am, with Sarah Palin, I am not criticizing her choice. The question I'm asking is she prepared to be the kind of mother that she would like to be, and also to be a president? Because we have to look at it as she's a potential president of the United States. The way I feel is you can have it all. I mean, that was sort of the issue during the feminist period. Women can have it all, and why not? And we can have it all, and everything. Everybody soon came to the realization is you can have it all, but you can't do it all. Something has to give. And if you're in a high-powered career and, you know, you're working or you have to travel a lot, then you know what? You give up some of the advantages of being the kind of parent you might want to be at some times in your life, or the kind of wife you want to be. If you decide to take time off, then you sacrifice your career. But you can't do it all. And so something has to give. And so I think it would be irresponsible for us not to find out from Sarah Palin. I would like someone to ask her, where will your priorities be if you become the president, the vice president, the president, because you can't do both all the time and do it the way you want. Now, I mean, she's got five children. She has a child. One child is about to give birth to another child,
right.
And that child needs her mother.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll then have the responsibility. The child's not married. Who knows whether she will get married? You know, I don't know whether they said she would for political reasons or not. You know, I have no idea. The Down syndrome child is a friend of Sarah Palin's wrote me a very angry letter and said, you know, how can you say that she should be with her child because she, you know, Down syndrome babies are easier to deal with because they don't walk until they're 2 1/2.
Hmm.
But I happen to know a lot about Down
special
syndrome.
Needs, right.
My son has Sprinson syndrome, which is another kind of syndrome, but has many. He was sick for 16 years.
Oh, my.
Severely learning disabled. And, you know, I know what it took. I had to quit my job. I only had one child. My husband was editor of the Washington Post. There was never a question that Ben was going to quit as editor of the Washington Post and take care of Quinn. I mean, there would be months at a time where I'd be living with him at Children's Hospital.
Mm.
But I mean, and it was unthinkable for me that Ben would do that, you know, and that I would keep on as reporter at the Post,
mm-hmm.
doing my work. I mean, it just wasn't even, it was never discussed. It was never an issue. Now, that's me. That is how I wanted to live my life. But I know that Down syndrome children take an enormous amount of care, and that the early stages of development are the most important time for a Down syndrome child to get the kind of love and attention and care from the mother and the father. And when you talk about mothers, you know, we heard in both conventions, and particularly, you know, in both the Democratic and the Republican convention, many, many times, over and over and over, practically everybody who made a speech talked about single working mothers. You never heard anyone say single dads. Why is Sarah Palin's husband not a hockey dad? Why is she the hockey mom?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you ever saw the movie Saving Private Ryan, and there was the first, you know, 15 minutes of it was the D-Day landing on the beaches in Normandy, and all these young boys dying. And what were they doing? They were crying for their mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was saying, dad, dad, you know. They were crying for their mothers. There's a difference between mothers and fathers. And so knowing that you have this Down syndrome child who needs the love and attention and constant attention and stimulation and therapies and doctor's visits and all of that from the parents, from both parents, and the teenage daughter who needs help, and two other young children at home. I think they're 8 and 13 or something like that. She can't do it all. She's not doing it all now. She has it all, but she's not doing it all now. And, you know, I want to know that the president is going to put his or her country first. And so I think that's a legitimate question for us to ask Sarah Palin.
Interesting. We're going to welcome phone calls for Sally Quinn, and we'll take them in a moment. We have a lot to talk about with her. She, of course, a journalist for the Washington Post. She's very interested in religion. We can move that direction. We can talk about the presidential debates, why this is one of the most important elections we have ever had. If it is true that she can, Sarah Palin, handle a motherhood of many, many responsibilities, plus be vice president, plus possibly be president of the country. And we are looking at the presidential debates, the fate of the country. We have yet to talk about the whole future, as the president said last night, of the American economy being in danger and what we do about that. So there's a lot on the plate. 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. Or send an email if you'd like. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Sally Quinn, and we start with Andy from Milwaukee. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How are you, Andy?
Good. A couple of brief things. First of all, it's Sarah Palin. I mean, I think that the way that it's been handled is, I think McCain has actually used her as a kind of affirmative action poster girl, which I've been a little bit despondent about. And secondly, the real reason why, you know, I called is, you know, there's not much mainstream public coverage that I've seen, maybe one or two little things here, but Sarah Palin apparently had her police chief, or approved of her police chief's policy to require rape victims to be billed for the rape kit after they'd be sexually assaulted. And while there are only a few thousand people in Wasilla, and perhaps, you know, the policy was never actually implemented, I think that that demonstrates a real problem, a real disconnect about what she says or what she is to women as a symbol or as far as she understands these issues. I think that, you know, whether or not, you know, they actually did bill people, the fact that she was one of very few communities before the practice was banned in Alaska, it's disturbing. And I think it shows that lack of judgment. And I think that also carries over into, I think, how cavalierly she treated her own daughter's pregnancy. I don't agree with people who say that that's off limits because, you know, it's an underage daughter who's having a child. And I think that it's not a simple black and white issue. My big concern overall is I think Sarah Palin just doesn't get it.
Sally?
I think that I'm not exactly clear what happened with the rape kits. I think that they were charged for it and under her regime, and then it got turned around and they started paying for it themselves. But I think, you know, I don't think that she's been a great advocate for women's issues. I think that's particularly true. I mean, I don't think she's been very supportive of, for instance, you know, she's anti-abortion, and yet she is not in favor of sex education except for teaching abstinence. And she's not in favor of helping out pregnant women, of funding care of pregnant women once they do get pregnant. And then she's not in favor of any kind of welfare or helping women out once they do have the children. Now, the whole issue of abortion is interesting to me because she is in favor of, she believes that conception begins, life begins at conception. And she believes that abortion is murder. And she is against abortion in the case of rape or incest. Now, I have to say that I think that that is very consistent. I don't understand people who say, I'm against abortion except in the case of rape or incest, because if life begins at conception, then if you abort a fetus that was conceived in by rape or incest, you're still killing a human being if you believe that abortion is murder. She also believes in the death penalty, and she has said, I believe that, as she said, if anybody put a bill in front of me and said, sign it in favor of the death penalty, particularly in the case of someone who would kill a child, she said, I would sign it instantly. So the question is, if life you believe that life begins at conception, and if you believe that abortion, therefore, is murder, you have to believe that, because if you kill a fetus, then you're committing murder. And if you believe in the death penalty, then do you believe that doctors who perform abortions should be executed and mothers who allow themselves to be to terminate their pregnancy should also be executed? That follows. I don't understand any other way that you can think about it, if those are the things that you believe.
Thanks very much for the call. This might be a good point for us, Sally, to talk just a little bit about your interest in religion. You say that you called yourself an atheist when you were 13 years old. And then the more you live, the more you realize the importance of religion and ethics questions and faith in the lives of all kinds of people in Washington and all over the world. Tell me about that. And now it's a very, very deep pursuit on your part. You're writing about it.
Yeah. Well, I was an atheist. In fact, you know, it's really interesting. I gave a speech at Harvard day before yesterday. Harvard doesn't have a religion major, oddly enough. They have a divinity school, but no religion major. And a lot of the chaplains are interested in getting a religion major started. And I'm very much in favor of that because I believe very strongly that everyone should study religion. But I'm not talking about being proselytized. I'm not talking about having people of faith teach other people about their own faith. I think that everyone should know about every religion. It should be, you know, it should be part of one's education, the way history and English and science and math are. But I was giving this speech, and I suddenly realized when I was working on it why I became an atheist, and it never occurred to me. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, I declared to my parents that I didn't believe in God and I didn't want to go to Sunday school. My father was just furious, and Alice in Wonderland, the new Disney movie, was coming out, and it was on a Sunday, and I told my father that I'd been waiting for this for months. You know, it was the big deal, and I told my father I had a stomachache, because I always got a stomachache on Sunday morning, so I wouldn't have to go to Sunday school, because I didn't believe any of it. And he said, well, if you're too sick to go to Sunday school, you're too sick to go to Alice in Wonderland. Well, I knew that he wouldn't be that cruel, that he would keep me from going to this. But he was. He made me stay home, and I missed the premiere of Alice in Wonderland, which was, I'll never get over it. And I never believed in God. And when I was 13, I actually learned the word atheist and announced that that's what I was, much to my parents' horror. But I realized that my father was in the military. He was during World War II, he was the head of intelligence in the 7th Army in Germany, and he liberated Dachau, the concentration camp.
Oh.
And he had his staff photographer take pictures of Dachau and all of the inmates at Dachau. And we had these scrapbooks. He had these scrapbooks that we looked at. And it occurred to me only this weekend that I looked at those pictures as a child, 5 years old, and thought, there can't possibly be a God.
Yes.
Because how could God allow, if there is a good, loving God, how could God possibly allow this to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say my prayers every night, you know. Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep, you know. And then I thought, well, God didn't listen to their prayers. Why should he listen to mine?
Right.
And so I went through my whole life. I mean, I was in the hospital for a year in Japan. My father was sent off to the front lines in Germany, and I got very sick, and I couldn't eat. I was on an IV. And because the Tokyo General Hospital was where they sent all the most severely wounded soldiers from Korea, the pediatrician decided that parents couldn't visit their children because there wasn't enough nursing staff to calm them down when their parents left. So I wasn't allowed to see my mother for months and months at a time. And we ultimately flew back on a plane to Brook General Hospital in San Antonio. We flew back on a hospital plane full of the most severely wounded soldiers, and a lot of them died on the plane. And my mother would, well, I was too sick to do anything, so I was strapped in a litter. There were no seats, only litters on this flight. But my mother would go and just hug the soldiers, and because they were all crying for their mothers. And you know, some of them were bleeding to death. And I thought, how could a good, loving God allow this to happen? You know, it was just the most heartbreaking experience and vivid experience. So I became very contemptuous of religion. Angry about it and contemptuous. And I looked at, you know, as I began to sort of study world history in college and all of that, I saw all these horrible things that have happened and have been done in the name of the religion. I mean, the Inquisition and the Crusades and, you know, the anti-Semitism and the Holocaust and, you know, although that wasn't really done in the name of religion. It was against a religious group of people. But not only was I not a believer, but I was very hostile and contemptuous of religion. I sort of backed into doing what I'm doing now as a reporter, because I began to realize after 9/11 that everybody was sort of going around saying, who are all these people? Who are Muslims? What is Islam? What is this about?
Mm-hmm.
And that I didn't feel we were covering it. I wasn't learning enough in the press, you know, to satisfy me. And then, you know, the American politics, religion, evangelicals, and the right-wing fundamentalists had sort of hijacked American politics and essentially were partly responsible for George Bush getting elected, and that a lot of politicians were playing to that base, and even people like John Kerry and Howard Dean, who were not comfortable talking about their faith, were sort of forced to because they felt that they couldn't get elected otherwise. And actually, it's only been in this particular election where the Democrats have sort of taken faith back because of Obama being so comfortable speaking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very pluralistic. I mean, he gave an incredible speech 2 years ago to the Sojourners Convention when he talked about faith and politics and his faith, but basically made it very clear that we are a nation of believers and non-believers. He was very pluralistic and very inclusive, and really just hit the right note, whereas so many of the right-wing fundamentalists have been very exclusive. You know, ours is the only right way to believe, and anyone else who doesn't believe the way we do is going to go to hell.
So, Sally, how have you been able, or maybe you're still on this road to understanding, because I know they can go on and on.
Yeah.
How do you answer, then, that basic question of how can God allow all of that suffering, Dachau and you in that airplane and the other people dying in September 11?
Right.
That's a huge question.
Well, I mean, this is the question, isn't it?
Right.
The question. You know, as I said, I got involved in this because I saw after 9/11 people really beginning to search for meaning, you know, in a way that I had never realized before. And I didn't even know what religion most of my best friends were, whether they even went to church. But I felt that we needed to do more about it, and I felt the paper wasn't doing it, so I went to Don Graham, who is the the owner of the Washington Post, and said, we ought to do something on the web. And he said, you do it. And I said, I don't know anything about religion. I don't know anything about the Internet. And he said, well, do it anyway. So I got John Meacham, who was the editor of Newsweek and a religion scholar, to be my co-moderator for On Faith, which is the website that we do on the Washington Post website. And so we invited a panel of all these different, every possible religion you can imagine to be on and to have these discussions and to have people be able to talk about what their beliefs are. And, you know, we've got Hindus and Buddhists and Greek Orthodox and Jews and Catholics and Mormons and Muslims and everybody, Wiccans, we've got everything, atheists, agnostics. And I do a half-hour video interview a week with people about their faith or lack of faith. And you know, it's really interesting because I always ask the religious people, the believers, how do you explain suffering? And I have yet to get a satisfactory answer. Everybody has a way, everybody struggles to answer the question, but no one has answered it to my satisfaction. How do you explain an all-powerful, all-loving God who can allow suffering on this earth.
So the quest goes on. Sally Quinn is our guest. We're going to be welcoming more phone calls. We covered a lot of territory, religion. She's a reporter for The Washington Post, and she has founded and co-moderates with John Meacham from Newsweek a special blog on faith and also a video which interviews all kinds of people on a number of really deep religious topics. She has written extensively about politics for a number of years now. We want to talk about Elizabeth Edwards. She shares, I think, many of our deepest concerns about her health and also our admiration for this remarkable woman, but she also takes her to task for why so silent and why knowing about John Edwards was doing and could possibly become the president, she didn't say anything. So these women who enable this kind of behavior and more, we will talk about with Sally Quinn and welcome more of your phone calls. We also have this email, so if you'd like to join us by email, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And our number is 800-486-8655. I just want to remind you, because before you know it, this date will be here. October 30th, we started doing extensive political broadcasts 2 years ago when this race started. We went to Dubuque for the caucuses in Iowa, and we're going to be having a special live broadcast Thursday, October 30th, which is a matter of weeks from now, from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. Your vote, your future. Mike Uchet will be with us. We'll have guests from both major political parties the first hour, and then students from Marquette University as they talk about the youth vote. And it is, as our first hour indicated, their future. They're dealing with a lot of huge, huge issues. Global warming, the financial situation, stem cell research, alternative energy, et cetera, et cetera. So please join us in the audience. It's free. You just need to call to register so we'll know how many people will be there. In Dubuque, we asked everybody to bring chocolate cake, and people brought chocolate cake and then some, and we had a rip-roaring good time. So we invite you to register 414-227-2047, 414-227-2047. Back with Sally Quinn in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sally Quinn is our guest this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The president said last night, and I'm not sure how long it's going to take to figure out this whole economy, Sally, that the whole future of the American economy is in danger. What were your thoughts when you heard him say that?
I had a lot of different thoughts. I thought that... First of all, let me just say that this whole issue is way above my pay grade.
Mine too. And, a lot of people's, I think,
you know,
right?
I don't understand any of it.
Yeah.
And I feel much better saying that, knowing that no one else understands it either.
Mm-hmm.
All the geniuses in Wall Street don't understand it. Paulson clearly doesn't understand it. Bernanke doesn't understand it. George Bush clearly doesn't understand it. And everybody is playing, you know, sort of, you know, trying to figure out what went wrong and what to do about it. And nobody knows what the right answers are. So just given the fact that I don't have a clue, my thoughts were, first of all, that, you know, Bush was reading from a teleprompter something that someone had put in front of him. I didn't get any sense. Even though he talked about, you know, we're heading into this crisis and all of that, I didn't get any sense of crisis from his tone. I mean, there was no sense of urgency, which I thought was odd. It was kind of off-putting in a way. And I didn't get any sense of feeling that he knew what to do or that he was in charge, which he's not, actually. I mean, he sort of turned it over to Paulson. And is hoping that, you know, the Congress will step in and help work something out. So, but I also felt as though, you know, this was a sort of culmination of 8 years of the philosophy of deregulation and lack of oversight. And and the other thing I thought, the irony of this is that it's the Republicans who are always anti-government, you know, and that essentially what they're talking about is creating a socialist state, which is even more to the left than most Democrats are, by trying to sort of take over Wall Street. So it's all weird and bizarre and very scary.
It is scary.
And it's scary because I don't think that anybody knows what they're doing.
Right.
And I don't have an opinion on whether they should, you know, whether the $700 billion bailout is the right thing to do. I mean, Chuck Schumer said it should be $150 billion, but I don't think that's enough. But on the other, I don't think that there should be compensation to the people who perpetrated this. I think that there should be more oversight and more regulations and all of that. But I don't know how to solve it, but I didn't get any sense of confidence watching the speech last night that the president had any better idea than I did. Mm-hmm. And that's really scary.
Yeah. Let's go to Bob from Richland Center. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Good morning. I just like Sally's interpretation of Sarah Palin, at a comment made by Orrin Hatch at the Republican National Convention, how well qualified she must be for this job of vice president, because she had served as a mayor of a small town and a governor, and had actually made some budgets up, and they tried to say that she's far more qualified than a community organizer. They tried to characterize Barack Obama, you know, as in a real not having a whole lot of responsibility. And I'm still shaking, I guess, to think that that would be that was presented that way.
Well, I've worked over the years. I've been on the board of Children's Hospital for many years because of my son's illnesses, and so I've worked with community organizers trying to help sick children and the community and poor children. I have just enormous amount of respect for those people. And I think that was a mistake to put down community organizers. But I also think that when you look at Barack Obama, it's almost 2 years now that he has been on the campaign trail and learning and studying and meeting people and having been in the Senate. I think run one of the most extraordinary campaigns with millions and millions of dollars. Certainly more well-run than Hillary's was, and everybody thought that, you know, they'd run the White House, they should know how to run a campaign. And so I think that his experience and the knowledge that he's gained in the last 2 years, and the way he's run his campaign show that he's a lot more prepared and qualified.
And thanks for the call. Let's go to Molly from Genoa, Illinois. Hi, Molly.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey, I have a comment, or actually, I would like to play the advocate with Sally Garland. I guess the judgment you had against whether she can run the country and picking between running the country and being a mother. And I'd like to flip it around and say, you know, would you put the same question to Barack Obama, who has two young children? You know, we fought for many, many years for equal rights for women. We finally got to a situation where they are equal in this family and the husband is going to stay home with the children. Yet now we have the feminists or the liberal feminists complaining that she should stay home and be a mother. So I'd like to know why it doesn't go both ways in the society.
All right. Sally?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, I didn't say she should stay home and be a mother. I said she's going to have to make a choice because she can't do both. She can't have five children, particularly a child who's about to have a child and a Down syndrome child, and be an effective vice president or president. So she's going to have to make a choice of where her priorities are. That's what I said. And why you don't put the same question to men is exactly what I was trying to say, because men and women are different, and the role of mother and the role of father is different. That is just the way it is. That's not the choice that I'm making. I'm simply talking about that is what it is in our society. And if you want to talk about family values, I asked the same question of John McCain, but it doesn't matter. John McCain hasn't even lived with his family since 1980 or 82. John McCain has lived in Washington, and Cindy McCain has lived in Arizona and raised all of those children by herself. And he's here all during the week and travels constantly on the weekend. And so he's been an absentee father. When Cindy McCain went to Bangladesh and adopted that child, she got off the plane and said, "This is our new daughter."
Right.
And he said, "Oh, okay, fine, whatever." Because he wasn't going to be raising that child. That is the difference between mothers and fathers. And no one ever said a word about John McCain. You don't ask the same questions of men. Barack Obama has been traveling, and Michelle has had a very limited amount of time on the road because she wants to be back and with her two daughters. So when Bill and Hillary were campaigning, they had three people, Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea, out on the road all the time, and Barack Obama was out there by himself most of the time. Michelle would make campaign trips, but she would try to be back, you know, to make sure that she was there with her two children, where Obama was traveling. I think that, you know, John McCain says put your country first, and we know he would do that and has done that for the last, you know, 30 years with his family. He's put his job first and his country first. And I think that Barack Obama is a father, and he's traveled all over the world. I mean, traveled, you know, spent the last 20 months on the campaign trail campaigning, and as I say, his role as a father is different. I mean, most people who go and actually are in combat and wars are men who leave their families for years at a time and risk their lives. That is the way, you know, that is a biological fact, and it's certainly a cultural fact in this country. So that the answer to your question is no, I would not put the same question to both of them. Because I know the answer. I know what John McCain's priorities would be. We've already seen that. And I know that Barack Obama has, in the past 2 years, basically, you know, put his campaign before raising his children.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelle Obama and Cindy McCain have been the caretakers. So the answer is, and I think we all have a right to ask this question, where will her priorities be? I'm not making a judgment about what they should be. I know what mine would be, particularly because I have had a special needs child. I know where I would be right now with that child, and I'd be with my seven 15-year-old child who's having a child. That would be my choice. But I'm not Sarah Palin, and I'm not going to make a choice for her, but I think that we have a right to know as citizens where her choices and her priorities will be.
And thanks very much for the call. Sally Quinn, thank you so much for being with us. We covered a lot of issues. I hope that was okay with
we
you.
We could go on.
I know.
There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah. So I hope to talk to you again. Thanks, Sally.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Sally Quinn, our guest this hour of the program, she's a journalist, works for the Washington Post, and has this interesting new blog, I guess you call it, that looks at religion and politics and religion, just religion, interviewing people, religious scholars of all denominations, co-moderated by John Meacham, who's editor of Newsweek on Faith, a conversation on religion. We thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. We thank Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again on Monday. We'll be looking at the presidential debate, which is supposed to take form some kind of form tomorrow, and we'll talk about what we saw and heard on Monday. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network.